Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Thursday, August 9th, 2018. And with me today, I have Andrew Orr. How are you, Andrew?
I'm good. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you here. And thank you for taking one for the team, because you're running exclusively in macOS Mojave Beta right now.
Yes, I'm cutting edge.
And it's been nothing but a bundle of headaches as far as audio goes. But with the most recent update, audio seems to be working again, at least to some degree. So that's awesome. And Adam Christensen from the MacCast, how are you?
Hey, how are you doing? I'm good.
Awesome. I'm doing well. Glad to have both of you here. Let's start off with Apple and privacy. And Andrew, you found a piece online that was possibly suggesting that maybe Apple isn't the privacy hero that we think.
Yeah, so it's this article I found by Bloomberg, and the author writes about how app developers have access to your information, and then afterwards, you know, no one is really sure what they do with that information. Like, there's always a possibility that a developer who accesses your contacts to provide their service, even though Apple has a rule that says they can't store and sell that data, this author is saying, well, how can I trust them, basically? But the problem I have with the article is that the whole premise of it is about comparing this to Facebook and the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which is completely different, because what app developers do, they, you know, they have to ask permission. This is just standard how it works. Whereas what Facebook did, all of those developers were harvesting your information without permission, or in a way that wasn't really clear what you were doing.
And Apple, they have the ability not only to shut down an app, meaning take it off the app store so you can't get it, but they can also remotely kill apps if they feel that's necessary.
So, yeah, but the problem there is, and this article points that out, is that just killing the app or removing the app or deleting the app or even turning off the app's access to that data, which users have the ability to do, doesn't remove that data from the third party. Like, the data that they've already, it stops new data from going in, obviously, but they still have that data that you gave them access to.
Oh, that's a good point. It's not like Apple can reach through your phone into someone else's server and delete information.
Yeah. Well, and that's yeah. And of course, that's anything on the internet, right? Anytime you give your information to any service, once they've slurped it up, they have it, you know. Now with GDPR and all this new stuff in the UK, you're supposed to have the ability to request that they move it, and the people are supposed to remove it. But that's where this article gets into weird territory. And even, you know, not defending the Cambridge Analytica stuff, but the same token with Facebook, you know, like, once the information has been let out, you know, you're at the behest and the trust of whoever slurped up that data or whoever you gave access to that data for. And yes, the Facebook stuff, I agree with you, Andrew, with the Facebook stuff, it was a little less clear, but, you know, on the Facebook side of things too, people do have controls and a lot of ways to control their privacy within Facebook, and a lot of people just don't use it. And by the same token, you know, for Apple's side of this equation, a lot of people just don't pay attention to what data they're giving people access to, and they don't really think about it. They think more about, oh, this is a feature I want to use in this app, or more frequently what I find, this is a feature that I don't even know why you need access to this data, but I'm going to let you have access to it anyway. And so I get a little bit frustrated by, you know, the constant, well, this always has to come back on the company that's providing the service, right? And that we as users of these services and users of these this technology, well, we're too dumb to understand any of this stuff, so we have to be protected from ourselves. And, you know, for me, it's an ambiguous line. I go back and forth across both. You know, I see both sides of the argument. But more and more these days, it feels like we fall back on, oh, well, it's the responsibility of the internet service provider, or it's the responsibility of the company making the operating system to protect us from ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that's where I get a little bit frustrated with articles like this. It's like, you know, where is that line? The government has to protect me. Big corporations have to protect me because I'm obviously too stupid to figure it out for myself.
Yeah. And that feels to me like a lazy stance for people to take. I don't want to take the time to figure out what a company is doing with my data. Therefore, the government should just protect me.
Yeah. Or a corporation. You know.
Yeah.
Or an internet service provider, right? I mean, this is, you know, and this is where things like GDPR, which I think philosophically is an amazingly really good thing. And I think we talked about this when GDPR was going on. You know, being a developer myself, though, it leaves a lot of open-ended questions, like even to the point of, you know, if I am a good, responsible developer, right? And when people leave my service, I not only have I never used that data outside of the terms of service that I needed that data for. So let's say I do an app where I need, for some reason, access to contacts data, and I slurp up someone's contact data to use for a service inside my app. Maybe it's sharing with other people in your contacts or finding other people. I never sell it. I never do anything with it. And when you delete the app or remove the service, I have hooks in there to say, okay, go through my database and delete all my data, which is basically what GDPR wants you to do. By deleting the data, I have no way to access or prove to anybody that I actually deleted the data. So if I get audited or a government agency comes in and says, okay, prove to us that you were doing the right thing, it's like, oh, well, I really can't. So there's a lot of those questions that go on when you start getting into this stuff. It's really complex. And if you just start wholeheartedly blocking third-party apps access to this, what you're doing is you're going after the potential bad actors, but then there's all those good actors that are providing services and software that maybe people really want and could really benefit from that also get impacted in potentially, you know, negative ways. It starts to get to a point where it could stifle innovation. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough thing, right? And I think Apple's trying to do the right thing as much as possible without also binding the hands of developers who want to make really cool stuff.
Yeah, I see that. And I'm starting to think that maybe the approach that I should take to allowing or not any developer to have access to my data is, do I feel I can trust them to delete it if I ask them to? And if the answer is no, then I shouldn't give them access in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my approach. Like, whenever I use a new app or a new service, I examine their privacy policy to make sure, you know, just to find out what they're doing with my data.
I also like... go ahead, Adam.
I was just going to say on that subject, my new default posture, and I think this is good for a lot of people, is you install a new app, and inevitably it's going to start popping up those requests for permission. And it could be, you know, can I access your camera? Can I access your photo library? Can I access your contacts? And it gets a little tiring, which I think is why a lot of people just click okay, 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 right? Because they're like, obviously, if the app is asking, it needs this for some feature or service. I would argue do the opposite. And this is what I've started to do, is just every answer is no. If I haven't had the time to review, you know, why does it need access to my contacts? So you say no, and then inevitably, if you go to use a feature within the app where it needs access to that data, it will often, smart apps will re-ask and say, okay, yes, you're trying to share this, you know, or you're trying to find new friends on the service. Do you want me to, you know, search through your contacts? And at that point, I think what your advice is exactly right, Jeff. You might want to go out and say, okay, do I really need to do this? Or can I go look in my contacts myself and just plug in an email? Or is there another way to do this without giving them whole, you know, unfettered access to my contacts data? Or my camera data, or like wait until the you're using the feature within the app that needs that data and then turn it on. Because mm-hmm. chances are, you know, I have a lot of apps where I never use the feature where it actually needed access to that data. So now I haven't given the developer wholehearted, you know, early access to that data that they really don't need access to.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah. And it's worked out really well for me. You know, I just immediately say no to everything, you know, like the camera apps and stuff like that. Because I have apps where it wanted access to my photo database, but I'm not using the feature where it would need access to photos in that app. I'm just not using that part of the app. Yeah. So
I've occasionally had an app ask for permission to access some data collection, my contacts, whatever, on my iPhone. Right. And I know it doesn't really need that access for whatever it's going to do. Uh-huh. And but the developer really wants that, so they won't let the app go any farther.
Right. And that's another part of GDPR, too.
Yeah. And so for those apps, I just delete the app and find something else.
Mm-hmm. So another thing, what's nice about these conversations and this stuff coming up around privacy too, especially things like the GDPR, is the GDPR legally requires that you are not allowed to ask for data that you're not going to use. Like you have to implicitly say, okay, this is the data I want access to. This is how I'm using it. And this is why I need access to it. You have to be upfront about that. And I think for so long in the development community, there's been this posture of, well, let's just get as much data as we possibly could ever maybe want or need. Yeah, we're not using it right now in a feature, but we might use it in a feature in the future. So let's just grab it now because we can. And I think what's good about these conversations is it's going to change that. I think more and more developers have to take the posture of, okay, I need this data, this is why, and now I will ask for it. You know, it's like reversing that model. Let's not just slurp up everything we can because we can. Let's be really deliberate and specific about what we're asking for.
Yeah, that's a lot better approach.
Go ahead. One last thing on that article. So the conclusion of that article, I think, is the best part of that article. And this is something I've thought about with Apple in the past. And it's saying, you know, Apple can take this privacy thing a step further, especially when it comes to data like your contacts, is like, give the developer the ability to implicitly ask for specific fields of data. Because very frequently, probably what they need, and this is the problem right now, is if a developer needs an email address, I believe the way the API works is they ask for access to the contacts. I don't know if they can selectively then only slurp up the data they need, or if they have to grab the whole, or if they just get shoved to the whole database. I would hope it was the latter. But even more specifically is, why not just give me the ability to say, okay, you need access to my contacts. You can have access to the email addresses and that's it. Or you can have access to the phone numbers and that's it. Right. And be more direct about what they have access to. And then on the flip side, you know, you're right, is if also when I delete the app, can it go back through and delete the data on the third party? That's a little bit trickier, and I'm not sure they could ever accomplish that. And again, you know, once they have the data, they could make a copy. Who knows what's going on? So,
right. Yeah. All right. So I think the big thing here is we need to take a more active role as developers and as users in deciding what data is going to get shared.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's always going to be bad actors out there that are going to try and game the system. And, you know, Apple is, I think, doing better than any other company. They're trying to do as much as they can. I do want to point out, I think, Andrew, you mentioned earlier, the rule about not selling your contact data and stuff like that. That's a relatively new rule. I think Apple's just implemented that in the past few months. which was another complaint, and I think is a valid complaint. You know, that should have been in place much, much earlier. Those rules, even though they're, I mean, they're almost technically unenforceable, right? Like, Apple's not going to be able to go through and audit all these third-party app developers to make sure that they're not selling that data. But historically, they've done a good job of when that gets exposed. You know, I think the most famous one was the Path sort of data breach, where Path was slurping up people's contact stuff without even asking for permission. Mm-hmm. You know, they reacted to that very quickly and shut it down and got it changed. Path was able to avoid being banned from the App Store, but, you know, Apple will take those actions if they can. But, I mean, policing that is almost impossible. So the better approach is, you know, we need to be more responsible about what we're giving developers access to. And if Apple can continue to add more controls to restrict that access and to the data and which bits of data is being accessed, I think that's the right approach.
Yep, I'm with you. All right, I'm going to move us on because I want to make sure we have time to talk about this other thing. So, Adam, you and I, we're both fans of Anki.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the company that makes the Overdrive artificial intelligence robot race car things, which I think we both have. I know I have an Overdrive kit. You have one too, right?
I have the original. Yeah, it wasn't called Overdrive originally. I don't think it was called, I can't remember the name of the product. But yeah, the one they showed off at the Worldwide Developer Conference with the artificial intelligence powered, you know, cars.
Yes. Okay, so then I have, I guess, what's the second generation of that, which is Anki Overdrive. And then they also make the Cosmo robot. It's like a little, fits in the palm of your hand robot, sort of looks like a tractor that you can program. And so it's a really cool little robot, and it's really a great educational tool as well. So it's this cool thing. Now Anki is coming out with a new robot, which is about the same size as the Cosmo, and actually looks a lot like the Cosmo as well. But it takes the need to have your iPhone as a supplemental brain and puts all of that into the robot itself. And they're turning it into a sort of like this mini assistant, companion assistant.
Yeah. It makes robot. It more autonomous with voice control.
Yeah. And so it's coming out in October, and there's a Kickstarter for it right now. So you can get it a few days early and $50 off. But I just kind of wanted to look at this a little bit because this looks really, really cool to me. And it seems to me like a really clever move on Anki's part, because they've been selling gobs of what I'll call toy robots or robot toys that have been funding their R&D while they move towards what I think they ultimately want, which is to be making personal assistant, home companion robots that aren't just toys.
Don't they already have a spinoff company that is doing that? The Misty Robotics? Is that a wholly separate company with like Misty people from? Yeah, I never got clear on that.
Was Misty part of them, or is that part of Sphero?
Oh, it's Sphero. You're right. I'm confusing Sphero and.
But apologize. there's another company doing sort of the same thing.
Right.
Yeah, because the idea behind Misty is that it's more of a utility type assistant robot as opposed to like the Sphero balls.
Very expensive.
The D2. Yeah.
All right. So sorry. Back to Anki.
Back to Anki. So what do you think about this?
I'm super excited about it. I was telling you in the meeting earlier, I was like very close to pulling the trigger on the Kickstarter, which is about $200. But the problem being is it's coming out in October when we're expecting new iPhones and new iPads. And like, I wish I had an unlimited bank account. You know, I wish I was Tony Stark or Bruce Wayne, but I'm not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, them taking the artificial intelligence to the next level. I wish I knew if what the voice assistant stuff was being driven by, if that's their own technology or if they're leveraging. I have a feeling they're leveraging like the Amazon Alexa APIs, but they don't mention that. And I know they have their own technologies. So I'm curious if it's fully autonomous or not. Were you able to tell? Because this just was announced this morning. So we're still kind of trying to parse through it a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're using their own technology for the voice parsing or someone else's. I do know that it links up with your Wi-Fi network, so it has an internet connection. And when you ask it questions, it can look up information on the internet and then feed that back to you.
Right, yeah. It has a voice control, kind of like Siri. So the idea is that this would be always on. It looks like it can dock itself for charging and stuff like that. My only concern again is the Anki Cosmo, and this looks like the same design or very, very similar design. It is pretty small. And so, you know, the idea that running around your house all the time, it can get hung up in transitioning from, you know, carpet, and obviously it can't go downstairs or upstairs or like, so it's mobility as a full-time, you know, assistant robot that's going to be following you around, answering questions and setting kitchen timers and stuff like that. It's going to be somewhat limited. So right. The marketing side of that is kind of like, yeah, okay, I get, you know, this is supposed to be my little home robot of the future that's going to follow me around and help me with all kinds of things like setting my schedule. But really, I'm going to be carrying him around from room to room and maybe setting him on the counter as I'm making dinner or something like that. So yeah. it's still very much a toy in that toy realm, but super cool in terms of you're talking about a lot of advanced technology here. And again, with the Cosmo, they've got SDKs and APIs. And so they give you, it's a pretty open platform, which is what's super exciting about it for me is Anki's been very, very open about allowing you access and coding access and, you know, at deep levels to see what's going on with the AI and the vision systems and stuff like that. So that's where I get jazzed about it.
Yes. Yeah, I'm with you. The fact that there's so much we can do already with the Cosmo is really cool and a lot of fun. And I'm just looking at the Vector and thinking, all right, now we're taking this to a new level. And while I would love to have the full-on, totally functional personal assistant robot in my home today, I get that we have to take baby steps to get there. And the companies that have tried to like really leap ahead, they haven't had success yet. And in many cases, the companies are gone. So, right. So a company that's taking a slower approach to this seems like a smart move to me. So I'm betting Anki's going to be around for a while and that we'll continue to see more sophisticated robot devices coming out from them. And they'll keep getting us closer and closer to that dream of the true personal assistant robot.
Yeah. All right. What they're getting really right here is the personality too. I mean, they focused very, very much on the personality and making this thing friendly and approachable. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason why it's continued to be small and tiny is because it's not intimidating. And that's a huge thing when it comes to robot assistants. So I think they're really focused on making it fun and personable and you become attached to it as you would a pet or, you know, another human almost.
Yeah. That's why I think I like how it is small. Like you said, Adam, that makes it more limited, but it also means that because you do have to, or you can carry it around with you, I think that does help form the personal attachment to it more than if it was something bigger that, you know, rolled around the house and followed you like a Roomba. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep, totally.
And the fact that they have designed it so that it's very easy to anthropomorphize because it reacts and acts as if it has emotion. That makes it so much easier to look at a device like this and create your own emotional attachment to it. And apparently, I'm assuming it has sensors on its outer shell, because they said if you pet it, you know, like stroke along its back, that it likes that. It must have some sort of sensors built into the back so it can tell when it's being touched.
I'm pretty sure Cosmo has that stuff as well.
Oh, does it? So, I've never tried.
At least has gyroscopes or vibration sensors, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, if you flip it over, he'll get really PO'd. Like it.
That's funny. I have never done that. No. All right. Apparently, I need to try doing some things that are a little less friendly with Cosmo, like turn it upside down and see how it reacts.
Yeah. Or if you shake him, he'll... You know, he'll get all jiggly and dizzy and, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. I have never done anything like that with a Cosmo. Huh. Apparently, I'm far too benevolent of a coder with Cosmo. All right. So, I would love to get a hold of one of these and play with it. Because Vector looks like a really cool little thing. And I'm really interested to see how it performs as a mobile assistant, unlike my HomePod or my Echo, which do their jobs well, but they are very stationary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the article I'm reading, it says right now at launch, you can set timers and answer questions about the weather, and it will give you facts about different things, but they have a lot more cool things in the works.
Yeah, see, this stuff's really exciting. And I just realized that I was getting so excited about the Vector robot, I stopped watching the time. We're way over. I need to wrap us up. Adam, thank you for being here today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was fun.
It was a lot of fun. Andrew, thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you here. Listeners, I am so glad that you were here, and thank you for putting up with me not paying attention to the time today. Let me know what you think about the App Store and privacy and the Vector robot, because I'm curious what you guys think about this. And thank you for being here. We'll see everyone again tomorrow.